This meeting we're doing today, we intend to augment the battle that has begun. It's been very well joined, particularly by the remarks that were made by spokesman Maria Zakharova of Russia concerning the British Empire and its legacy. Paul will probably say some things about that, so I'm not going to go through that myself. And there are, you can get this in the handout that we gave you when you came in the door. I do want to refer to something that Helga Zepp LaRouche said in her international webcast of Thursday. She said this: there are more and more countries, governments, and also political forces who are speaking out against the fact that many of these British operations were orchestrated. I think there is an increasing awareness that there is one country, which is really on the war drive against Russia, and despite nice words, by implication, also against China. And I think it is a very important turn, and that is the British Empire. Now, that's crucial for what we are here to discuss. Let me just point out that in Great Britain itself, we've had a few statements this week. For example, the former head of the Royal Navy, Admiral West, stated, "If I was advising President Assad, why would I say use chemical weapons? It doesn't make any sense. But for the jihadist opposition groups, I can see why it would." The former head of British Special Forces, Jonathan Shaw, said, "Why would Assad use chemical weapons? He's won the war." He said, "This is not just my view, but it's shared by other British senior commanders. There's no rationale whatsoever behind Assad's involvement. He's convinced the rebels to leave the occupied areas in buses. He's getting the territory. Why would he gas them? Jihadis and opposition groups would have much more motivation. They would want to keep the Americans involved." And then finally, former United Kingdom ambassador to Syria, Peter Ford, on Tuesday, April 17th, on the Tucker Carlson show, said, "There is a distinct possibility that we have been deluded. We've been suckered. I think the president's advisors have served him extremely badly." And so apparently former Ambassador Peter Ford is endorsing our polemic here about people being bamboozled and baffled that we've been talking to you about here for several weeks concerning the issue of the actual motor force of history, which is not the deep state, but the very shallow British Empire. Now, there's a particular thing I just want to note from Lyndon LaRouche before Paul gets started. And this is from Lynn's writing, Earth's Next 50 Years, actually the coming Eurasian world section of that. And he had the following to say about the United States. He said, "It is of urgent importance to note that the only chance for the United States to escape a general collapse of the U.S. itself would be to shift its national strategic perspective now to establishing a new world monetary and financial system with global objectives akin to those which President Franklin Roosevelt had intended as planetary perspectives for the immediate post-war period. Such a dramatic change could occur, of course, only under the most extraordinary pressures from events, only when it were clear to the relevant leading circles that a shift to an echo of a Franklin Roosevelt perspective for the world at large is the only real alternative to a hopeless sort of general global breakdown of the economy of the planet as a whole. Those imminent conditions for solving the crisis presently exist objectively, but it were necessary that that ominous fact of that imminent danger be frankly perceived subjectively." Now, Helga Zepp LaRouche has been working, as you know, together with her husband to get the United States to join China and Russia in the New Silk Road or the Belt and Road Initiative. The shift in subjective perspective is our job here in the United States. It's something that we've talked about and we've devoted our recent lives to. The pamphlet that we put out some time ago, "Robert Mueller is an immoral legal assassin. He will do his job if you let him," pointed out the issue of the Mueller investigation of Trump was intimately connected to all matters international and specifically to stopping the president from allowing the United States to engage with Russia and China in exactly this way that would reassert the outlook of President Franklin Roosevelt. And so what has happened is, as a result of some of the events of this week in particular, in the aftermath of the chemical attack on Syria, the attack by the United States in response to the false, non-existent chemical attack that happened in Syria, we've now seen a clarity, a clarification that's come on who the true enemy is. And so in that context, Paul Gallagher, who actually is, if you get the Mueller brief, you'll see a picture of Paul there. I think it's on page 6 of the Mueller brief, who appeared at that time back in 1983 on television as of March 24th to talk about the way in which Lyndon LaRouche had assisted President Ronald Reagan in proposing a new strategy for relations among all powers, but particularly the United States and the Soviet Union. And so Paul has been on the SDI question. So Paul has been doing a lot with Lynn for a long time. In the latest copy of the EIR, he has an article which is entitled "London Finance Dominates the World, Ruins Economies, Including America's." And so Paul's going to give us a briefing and an update, and then we'll have some brief amount of time for questions. So, Paul, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're very clear.
Thank you. to go a little further in what Dennis just started to begin with, the view of Lyndon LaRouche and this movement of the British Empire, which has been essentially an isolated view among Americans in particular for decades, has now been thrust into the center of world affairs, and particularly thrust into the center of the political situation in the United States. We have thus been thrust into the center of that political situation by the clear fact that the British Empire is demanding, as it did in World War One, is demanding that, and in preparing World War One, the British Empire is demanding that the United States, that the Trump administration in particular, decide which side is it on in a war between the British Empire and Russia. And that the president at the same time continues to be threatened with impeachment or other form of a coup, removal from office, if he does not take the side of the British Empire in that war against Russia and that incipient and increasing war against China. So we're now, by the fact that we have warned that this was the situation with the British Empire and its manipulations of the United States and its policies for the United States, we have been doing this for quite a long time, and Lynn really for half a century. We're now really in the center of this, and perhaps indicated by the very large number of views of those crucial interview and presentation that Will Wirtz did along with Virginia Senator Richard Black. So I want to read you this just as one example. This is from 2008, 7 months before the financial crash became evident as a global bank panic to most people. EIR published an article called "It's the British Empire, Stupid." And up to that point, and for a long time in American politics, it has been the vast, vast majority of opinion on the part of Americans has been stupid. we have been saying it's the British Empire, stupid, but that stupidity has been continuing and suddenly has been shattered by what's going on. So this article said, in modern legend, the global British Empire disappeared in the late 19th century, or at least at the end of World War II. It was replaced by the two superpowers, the Soviet Union and the United States. And now, with the demise of the Soviet Union, by the hyperpower, the United States. A more dangerous delusion could not be held. For as the LaRouche movement has documented extensively, especially in the 1994 to 97 period, the new British Empire has never been so powerful, nor so close to implementing its schemes for global chaos and destruction. This empire is not to be confused with the United Kingdom, nor even with the British monarchy per se. Its model is that of the older Venetian oligarchy, which functions as a financial oligarchical system of families, foundations, and other institutions dedicated to preserving their power in perpetuum and destroying all systems and forces, most especially the nation state, which stand in their way. We summarily provide a review of three major areas of ongoing British imperial power here. First, there's the economic financial role played by leading Anglo-Dutch financial institutions, who exercise an astonishingly substantial control over the physical necessities of life, such as food and energy. This will be the basis of what I'm talking about today. Second, there's the military role of British imperial forces, both visible and invisible, regular and irregular. Third, there's the British Empire's cultural warfare apparatus, the most aggressive force for the destruction of pro-human scientific culture globally. And then a direct quote from Lyndon LaRouche here. Now, that empire, which the British effectively control, except for dissident nations that don't like it, represents about one-fifth of the world's land area, about 30% of the world's population, controls 48 to 50% of the world's financial turnover, including the $3.5 trillion a day derivatives turnover, controls the majority of the world's international trade in what are called strategic metals, such as the metals that are required for most industry, controls the majority of international trade in petroleum. And he goes on about the Anglo-Dutch Swiss Cargill complex and other such multinationals. And the article then goes on. That is how Lyndon LaRouche summarized the financial power of the British Empire back in March of 1996. If anything, the share of world power wielded economically by the empire has increased over the last 10 years as of 2008. Much of the control is admittedly not on the surface. It is exercised through the London Stock Exchange, the London International Financial Futures Exchange, through the London Metal Exchange, and the International Petroleum Exchange. These are institutions where the actual disposition of the physical assets being traded is determined, not to mention the layers upon layers of speculative financial instruments created that are now in full collapse and threatening to bring the physical economy down with them. That last was in italics, that are now in full collapse and threatening to bring the physical economy down with them. When in the course of that year, 2008, the fact that the British financial empire was in full collapse became evident to everyone. It was not so evident then. We now clearly have a breakout situation where the combination of this financial power with the blatant attempt to force the power, military power of the United States onto the British Empire's side in a war against Russia in preparation for a war against China. This is facing every American at this point. The British institutions, and one clarification, which I'm sure Helga meant in talking about the one country demanding war on Russia, it's not a country. It's a financial and political empire. And it doesn't even have a country at its center. The United Kingdom or England or Britain is not a country at the center of the British Empire. Now, for that, you have to look to the City of London Corporation, which we're going to get into here. But the institutions associated with this, and notice that in that quote from LaRouche, he stresses that this is not a modern institution. This is not a national nation state institution. It's not of the modern era. It's medieval. but it's the institutions associated with it have been vociferously demanding, not just through the British government at all, but demanding a new alliance for war against Russia and China. They have used the word democracy, but they have called for explicitly for a new coalition of the willing, essentially made up of the remains of the British Commonwealth, the countries in the British Commonwealth plus the United States, and a few others like Germany, a coalition of the willing for war against Russia, and its Royal Institute for International Affairs, which is known as Chatham House most of the time, has just put out a call for the United States to continue bombing Syria and continue that bombing until Russia agrees to regime change, to give up defense of the sovereign regime of Bashar al-Assad as president of Syria. This is in a piece which the RIIA or Chatham House put out April 20th yesterday, that now that the U.S. has committed to military action, attacks can only be a means to an end. The route to putting enough pressure on Russia to convince it to agree to serious negotiations. Serious negotiations means ditching the Astana process, the Sochi talks, declaring them dead, and abandoning the facade that Russia became adept at exhibiting during the Geneva process. For Russia to behave seriously in negotiations, it has to believe that the U.S. is serious. This gives the United States, a unique opportunity to engage in a sustained, targeted military campaign against Assad's military assets that has wide international endorsement. Questionable statement there for sure. there are suggestions that last week's attack might be one-off, but such a campaign should not be halted until Russia agrees to serious talks on transition in Syria. Ultimately, Russia does not want its foothold in the Mediterranean to be composed of rubble. very clear what that's demanding. The presentation made by the Russian Foreign Ministry 2 days ago through its spokesman, Maria Zakharova, which Dennis referred to, should be read by everyone. This is an event completely unique in post-war history, where the foreign ministry, the government of a major nation, a major power in the world, has come out full bore in an expose, an attack on the policies of the British Empire as such in the immediate current period. And in doing so, has had the daring to go back through the two centuries since the formation of the British East India Company in the middle of the 18th century, and to document and in detail present the horrendous crimes, the almost unbelievable crimes in some cases, of the British Empire during that period, which, again, observe, that empire which began with a private corporation, the British East India Company, which already showed in the middle of the 18th century that it was capable of commanding Her Majesty's, at that time Queen Victoria's, of commanding Her Majesty's military forces at will in order to impose the looting of a private corporation on India in the first instance and on colonies in general. This is the way in which the British Empire has functioned. That presentation by Zakharova on behalf of the Foreign Ministry of Russia is an absolutely extraordinary event, which challenges us in the United States, again, to choose whether we are going to align ourselves with the overall most criminal force in history in terms of its toll of starvation, disease, death, by far the most devastating force in history, which is still demanding that the United States follow it, choose its side in a war against Russia, or whether we're going to instead stand up for the interests of the United States in taming Wall Street. And I'll get into the importance of the City of London and the banks of London in that regard, taming Wall Street through breaking up the Wall Street banks from their speculative divisions, which are usually headquartered in London, and instead issuing credit for the rapid development of new infrastructural platforms and development of a reindustrialization of the United States, an increase in its productivity, which alone can bring additional wage gains and can bring the United States economy back. That's our choice. Now, there is a film which has just been produced, which is what I wrote about in the EIR that Dennis made reference to. It's a very important film, even though it outside of England itself, so far, very few people have seen it. It is being presented at a kind of a film tour by its producers and major interviewees in Britain and in the United Kingdom. It has not yet had a showing in the United States. It's called The Spider's Web, Britain's Second Empire. And this film confirms in spades what I read to you from the EIR article from 2008 and everything that LaRouche has said regarding the predominant global power for evil of the financial interests centered in the City of London and does this in an absolutely unique way. That is the area which is not dealt with in Maria Zakharova's press conference, is the financial reestablishment of dominance. Not that the British Empire did not have financial dominance over the two centuries that she was chronicling, but the reestablishment of its financial dominance since the 1950s and the effective shaping of many economies for the worse, deindustrialization of the U.S. economy, the shaping of the menace of what is now Wall Street by the City of London over a long period of time. The conclusions from the film itself are that I think I can characterize them this way, as I wrote in the article, this unusual film will prove those wrong who believe that Britain long ceased to be an empire and has become just a clever manipulator or even a puppy of the great power of the United States. And likewise, those who think Britain's offshore banking havens, such as the Cayman Islands, represent merely a manageable problem, somewhat like Swiss banking secrecy, and are an obsession only of crusaders for economic equality and tax justice. What is proven here is rather the truth insisted on by Lyndon LaRouche and EIR for many years. Not only is London the central driver of geopolitical manipulations, coups, and wars against rival or rising powers, London is also the world's dominant financial power and has held the whip hand in making speculation, securitization, and drug and terror financing the main activities of global banking since the 1960s. Now, this film very clearly presents what we referred to in that 2008 article, that at the center of this problem of the reestablishment of British financial world domination after it lost its military empire by the 1950s, that the institution at the center of that is a medieval corporation. The City of London is not the City of London, you might put it that way. The City of London is a private corporation whose origins date from the 11th century AD, which was converted into a commune, or announced itself as a commune of guilds in the 12th century, and which is still run by those guilds, which are guilds of attorneys, of bankers, of traders, of bank traders of various kinds, of accountants, of similar private institutions. Believe it or not, the Royal Her Majesty's Revenue Corporation, HMRC, the British IRS, is a private corporation within the private corporation of the City of London. It prefers to collect taxes by negotiation rather than by any use of law, as this film demonstrates, and collects, depending on the size of the corporation, the location of the financial speculation, the wealth of the individual, collects precious few taxes of any kind. We start with Clement Attlee, who was the prime minister of that country, Britain, United Kingdom, 1945 to 1951. He said in 1950, "Over and over we have seen there is another power than that which has its seat at Westminster," that is the British Parliament. "The City of London, a convenient term for a collection of financial interests, is able to assert itself easily versus the government of the country." That, unquote, that was an understatement by someone who had been the prime minister of that country. The original secrecy haven, an offshore banking haven, was the City of London itself, beginning at the end of the 1950s and in the 1960s, in the creation. Well, let me go a little bit into something which is not described in this film, and that is that the post-war system of monetary arrangements among countries reflected very much the views of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who passed away immediately during the months in which it was being negotiated, the Bretton Woods Agreement. According to that agreement, just to take one aspect of it, a United States citizen or institution or interest could not maintain an account in which dollars were deposited outside the United States unless it could document that that account was for purposes of settling trade accounts. In other words, it was a company, for example, selling U.S. goods in France, exporting them to France, wished to be paid in dollars, and would deposit the dollars in its accounts in France and would use them in order to pay for the import of the actual conveyance of the goods produced in the United States, which were being exported to France. It would settle the remainder by returning it to the company in the United States. That kind of a trade account was the only account in which dollars could be deposited outside the United States. And it was not only the United States which had to follow those rules, but the other countries, the many other countries which were in the Bretton Woods post-war system. That was deliberately wrecked by the City of London. I won't go through the step by step how they did it, but it involved attracting American capital to come over to London to earn higher interest rates than were legal in the United States. That was under both the Bank Holding Company Act, the Bretton Woods system as a whole, and the Glass-Steagall Act. The interest rates were banks could charge were capped in the United States. And that banks could pay on deposits were capped in the United States. They were attracted to London by significantly higher interest rates in the range of 8 to 9%. And the City of London, which was the entity that was supposed to be regulating and enforcing the rules of the Bretton Woods system in England, made an extraordinary decision, and that was that dollar operations being conducted in London were not in the United Kingdom at all. They were officially, quote unquote, elsewhere. That elsewhere came to expand. But initially, it was the elsewhere in which the British Eurodollar market grew up. And just to give you one idea, the assets in that market were $500 billion in 1980. By 1988, they were $4.8 trillion. These are dollar assets in London. And by the 1990s, 90% of international loans were being made in dollars from London. Those loans, in many cases, were at rates up to 15%. This complete domination of international lending in dollars in London then very quickly led to the destruction of the Bretton Woods system. Most people understand that it ended in 1971 when the dollar, Nixon took the dollar off gold, but it ended before then when the City of London on two different times opened up a gold exchange market in which it exchanged gold for dollars at a devalued value of the dollar. There was much shouting at that time by the European countries that the United States was exporting inflation because the dollar was actually worth less than it was kept at in the Bretton Woods system. But in fact, it was entirely the operations of the Eurodollar market in the City of London, which caused the Bretton Woods agreements to fall apart. And what we have known for the last 40, almost 50 years as the floating rate exchange system, which has made speculation casinos what they are today, which has made Wall Street what it is today. This was only this complete domination of the use of the dollar in international use of the dollar outside was challenged very briefly by President Kennedy, who raised the issue repeatedly with his aides, that he had come to understand that large amounts of dollar creation was going on in London, that the capital controls on the dollar were being flouted in London, and more dollars were being created and circulated from London than in the United States. After his death, Walter Wriston, who was then the head of Citibank, made a public comment in Life magazine in an interview that we recently had a problem about the possible restoration of capital controls, but that problem has gone away. Not accusing Wriston of any involvement in that assassination, but he very clearly recognized that Kennedy's challenge to it was over. The U.S. Banks all moved their international divisions to London, where they remain today. You can go through many examples of the London divisions of these banks, which brought on the crash in 2008, for example. AIG, the biggest insurance company in the world, which, as people know now, was a major trigger for this collapse and bank panic in 2008. AIG committed those financial crimes through its London office, the AIG Financial Product, so-called, which was in London, and which caused the immediate bank panic and the failure of Lehman Brothers and then of AIG in September of 2008. The J.P. Morgan Chase, which effectively exposed the Dodd-Frank bill as ineffective and lost $7 billion in exposed the Volcker Rule as something which didn't work, lost $7 billion a few years ago, did so in its London international operations. The MF Global Corporation, another example, which went bankrupt in 2013 after looting, literally stealing, accounts for which it was broker-dealer, major farm families in the United States, other similar agricultural interests in the United States, for example, lost hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in the MF Global collapse. This was done through its this looting was done through its London branch. This, I could go on and on. This is where the international banking has taken place. Now, the City of London, that not the City of London, but that medieval corporation run by those guilds, which includes all the City of London banks, including the biggest bank in the world, HSBC, and others, that City of London then, from the 1960s on, began to create arms on islands which were UK territories, the Jersey, Guernsey, the Cayman Islands, the Gibraltar, Jamaica, Bahamas. Some of them have since become independent. These were arms, not of the UK. In fact, ever since then, as these places have become notorious for their tax evasion and hiding of financial crimes, ever since then, the British governments have been at pains to say that they have no control when they're asked, the way they have no control whatsoever over what the governors of these places do, even though they are nominated by the Bank of England to the British government and are appointed by the British government. They then have no control over what they do. And through these what the Bank of England itself calls the secrecy jurisdictions, the wealth of the world has been funneled into the City of London banks for the last 50 years. To cite one example, 3/4 of all of the hedge funds in the world have their headquarters in the Cayman Islands. Those arms of the City of London, and this is one of the most extraordinary things which is revealed by the co-producer of this film, John Christensen, who is a leader of the Tax Justice Network, who are really the ones involved in this, in the production of this film. At a presentation at a whiteboard in that film, Christensen shows the most extraordinary fact created shown in the entire thing. He says that up to $50 trillion worth of assets in the world are owned now by no one. They have no beneficial owners, which any government would be able to trace. He says that the Bank of England could create a registry of these many, many invisible trusts and the corporations which own the trusts and the trusts which own the corporations. They could create a registry of these things which are hiding perhaps $50 trillion in assets from either taxation or legal regulation or investigation of what they are doing, while at the same time enabling those assets to gain high rates of return and to be returned to the global financial system through the banks in the City of London. And that is the extraordinary thing which is documented in this film. I want to end by reading my summary of the conclusions which immediately jump out from Britain's Second Empire, this film. That nothing is more valuable than its revelation that the British Empire, Second Empire, has been the cause, unseen but by exceptional few, particularly Lyndon LaRouche, of great economic changes for the worse in the past half century. Capital flight from developing countries is $1 trillion per year, and half goes into the London-centered banking system. Over the period 1970 to 2008, before the crash, $944 billion in capital flight from sub-Saharan Africa alone went into UK offshore secrecy jurisdictions. Developing countries looted in this way by the terribly powerful incentive for their elites which is represented by, quote, offshore, unquote, are robbed of investment, development, and de facto become huge creditors of the City of London banks. Productive investment in the industrialized countries of Europe and North America has been disincentivized at all levels because it is regulated and taxed, while non-productive and securitized investment has the offshore world at its disposal, unregulated and untaxed. These nations' governments, too, are no match for London's, quote, elsewhere, unquote, when it comes to the revenue with which they try to invest in technological progress and infrastructure. The offshore havens are drivers of economic inequality in all parts of the world. London has been the cause behind the screen for the replacement of bank separation by bank deregulation, the looting of the developing countries, disinvestment in production, creation of the so-called 1%, terror financing, this is exposed in the spider's web in that film, in particular, and they discuss it in this way exactly, the deindustrialization of the United States can be traced directly to the power and influence of the City of London's financial empire on Wall Street, making Wall Street what it is now and making the United States what it is now, deindustrialized, afflicted by addictions, and constantly embroiled in war by the same British Empire. So I'll stop there.